Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist, and Xander Kegg, licensed social worker. We will be discussing some sensitive subjects, and I wanted to bring that to your attention. Some of the areas that we will be covering will talk about suicidal ideation and sexual assault and other areas as well. Just wanted to prepare you for that. I'm going to now turn it over to Xander.
Thank you, An. Yes, I'm really happy to introduce the listener to our guest today. Her name is Celia Sanya Daniels. Celia is an accomplished healthcare management executive with over 25 years of demonstrated success in managing, growing, and spearheading large and strategic programs in IT, healthcare, and life sciences for the Fortune 100 companies. Her bathroom to boardroom advocacy focuses on educating and empowering the LGBTQ plus community, spanning across public and private sectors, as well as medical and academic institutions. As an Asian Indian trans woman raised in a conservative family in southern India, Celia writes and speaks passionately about her personal struggles and challenges within her family, work, and community, both in the United States and in India. Celia is recognized as one of the top 20 LGBTQ leaders in biopharma and among the top 10 LGBTQ plus voices on LinkedIn in the United States and Canada. She's also listed in the top 100 LGBTQ plus women in DEI worldwide, alongside notable figures like Laverne Cox, Wanda Sykes, and Lily Tomlin. As the founder and CEO of Rebicon Consulting, she serves on the Ventura County Workforce Board and holds VP positions at PFLAG, which is Parents of Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and Stonewall Democrats of Ventura County, California. Welcome to the Umbrella Hour, Celia.
Thank you so much for having me, Xander. I feel so honored to be here. I have always followed your posts and your articles that you put on LinkedIn and other areas. I'm so honored to be here. And thank you so much for inviting me on to be here as well.
Congratulations on all of those accomplishments and honors. I like that list of people. Laverne Cox, Wanda Sykes, Lily Tomlin. Those are very notable people. So congratulations to you too. To being recognized in that way for the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Prior to the show starting, we were all talking about how we have a connection to Ventura County. I lived in Agora Hills, which is just over from Calabasas, first entry into Ventura County. My father lived in Thousand Oaks, Ojai, and Camarillo. And On, you said you had an experience living in Oxnard and Camarillo.
I was 19.
Yeah, so that was a couple years ago.
I was just a baby.
So much going on in this little town. And of course, we're shaking the world here from here.
Which is astonishing because most people don't even know where Ventura County is. They've probably never even heard of it. But the fact that all three of us have not only know about it, but have been there and spent considerable time there says something about the importance of it. Because otherwise, how could that happen?
Something special for us, this podcast.
If you haven't been to Ventura County, California, and you find yourself visiting the States or visiting California in particular, I really encourage you to take a drive up the Pacific Coast Highway between Los Angeles and Santa Barbara and visit the beautiful seaside towns of Ventura County. Really beautiful. You won't regret it. Cecilia, in your bio, you mentioned that you do a type of advocacy that you call from the bathroom to the boardroom. Can you tell us more about what that means?
When I came out as Celia, after working for 25 years in the corporate world, I thought companies are accepting. I thought they have corporate equality index of 100% and they would hire an executive like me in a heartbeat. And these are companies that are truly flying the rainbow flags and they have a lot more acceptance. And there are lots of companies like Accenture, IBM, Salesforce, AWS, Amazon Web Services. And a lot of these companies that I was so excited to come out and I started applying in these companies. And I saw in reality that these companies that talked more about their inclusivity were not really inclusive. When it came to senior executives, they don't want to hire people at a senior executive level in those companies. They are okay hiring you at a much lower level. And I saw so much of discrepancy. Even when I have the experience, I've got awards as a best supplier along 30 or 50 different vendors in some of my client sites. I was managing the life sciences West Coast. It was very performative in a lot of these companies. This is the time I was trying to come out, because the companies are truly inclusive, but they don't know how to hire a person at an executive level to manage and be a part of their executive leadership team. And to me, that was appalling. At one side of me is saying that, okay, now I was a brown man with so much of privilege in the IT industry, and I've come out as senior, and it's so different because I not only stepped into the shoes of a woman, but also a trans woman who happens to be in the bottom of the food chain. And are the companies truly inclusive? Are they mindful of people like me, a person of color, coming out and an executive in the industry to really include me into their leadership team? And that's when I felt like companies sometimes don't know how to integrate people like me. They're okay if you're a trans person, you come out as male to female or female to male. But when you come out as gender non-binary, it's somewhere where they're not able to put you in these boxes. If you look at LinkedIn, if you look at the world, there are so many DEI conversations, so many DEI conferences, so many DEI seminars, people write books about being DEI, but they always leave out people like me. It's kind of like the hidden figures coming again and again. I remember speaking at one company where I was talking about true inclusivity, and I asked the person, can I use the bathroom? And they said, there's a ladies' bathroom there, you can use it, Celia. And I said, no, I want to use the gender-neutral bathroom. And they said, it's 5 floors down, so I had to take the elevator. And it was only one building, a big building with 5 floors, and there was one gender-neutral restroom. I went there and used the restroom, and I came up. It almost took more than 10 minutes to go in and come out. Now, I asked them the question as to, why don't you have gender-neutral bathrooms in each floor? Because you have a lot more employees in your company. And they said, oh, but we have one there. It hit me so hard. And I told them, this is like hidden figures all over again, where civil rights was taken away from people who are just using the basic human needs. And to me, that mattered a lot, because it's not about me using the ladies' restroom, but providing an environment where you are truly inclusive from the bathroom to the boardroom. And boardroom is so important, because we have seen women struggling to be a part of the boardroom discussions, be part of the decisions in the company. And when women are struggling, how can trans folks even be in those conversations, be in those meetings, in those of decision-making ideas, and being part of that executive leadership? It hit me. We need to move the needle to a point where we look at inclusivity and diversity, equity, and belonging right from the bathroom all the way up to the boardroom. And to me, that carries volumes of conversations just in that little sentence. Inclusivity from the bathroom to the boardroom. And this is not about me. It's about people like me who are struggling to even be visible in an organization, but telling them that you are valued, you are known for who you are credible in spite of your authentic gender. You are a valuable employee, you're creative, you're productive, you're innovative. And that's the message that I take to the companies. And I empower companies to, sometimes they don't know how to do it, so I also tell them how to do it. So I educate, I engage, and I empower companies to be truly inclusive from the bathroom to the boardroom. And that's the tagline in my company. So thank you so much for asking, Zenda. It makes so much of sense.
So the reference to Hidden Figures, it's a beautiful movie about African-American or Black women in the United States working in aerospace industry and needing to use the restroom, but they had to use restrooms that were designated for people of color, but it wasn't in the building where they were working. And so they had to take all this time to go several buildings away. And so I like that reference. And then you're talking about major corporations that have achieved a score of 100% on the HRC, or Human Rights Campaign, Corporate Equality Index. They've probably done everything that you have to check off a little box on in order to get that score. And this has been an issue for me too, because some of the work that I've done in corporate settings, I've been talking about, it's one thing to, where are you setting up tables to recruit people? And then once you're bringing people in, how are you integrating them in, the sense of belonging that they have? How are they being integrated in? And then how are you retaining them? And so there are some gaps in between these areas that are not part of an index, perhaps. Exactly. And so each year, the Corporate Equality Index becomes more and more refined. Eventually, they'll get there. But in the meantime, there are going to be these gaps. And thankfully, there are individuals like you with consulting firms like you have that can go in and offer these tools and these strategies for them to figure out internally. because each corporation is going to fill those gaps in their own unique way based on their culture. Absolutely. So I love that.
How long ago did you come out as trans?
I think I came out since I was 4 years old. There is a time in our lives when we come out to your family, you come out in the community. And I came out in the corporate industry in 2017. It was just a few years before the pandemic. But in the community, I came out in 2011 as Celia. But in the workplace, I was afraid to come out because I thought, how do I really come out? I'm an executive. I was three levels below the CEO. And it was like a professional suicide. You come out and you know you're going to hit a rock wall. And sometimes your boss is going to tell you that we are so accepting to you. But and then they still have unconscious bias running in the back of the minds that I'm going to lose my clients. I'm going to lose my revenue. I'm going to lose my projections this year, this quarter. And that's what happened in those companies. They didn't tell me on my face that it's okay to be who you are, but I could sense that the companies were not ready. When you're an executive in a company and you come out saying that I am Celia now, I'm no longer Daniel, it hits them so hard that, oh my God, instead of showing the inclusivity, they started thinking about their own sense of revenue and the insecurity with all the targets that I had. And I was still achieving them, but they felt like, oh, but there could be a perception about you coming out as a woman. It's not going to sit well. People don't tell you directly on your face. Let me tell you that. Companies never tell you on your face directly, but they can imply indirectly through other means. They probably say, maybe I can pair you up with Joe. You know, Joe, it might be very supportive for you. You and Joe to work together. And then you know that this person is kind of shadowing you and he's going to take over your position. That's how it works.
What do you think it's going to take to get the executives to recognize that there's benefits to accepting people at your level?
There is a lot of benefits when you have diversity within the workforce. People who are contributing to the innovation and the creativity and the productivity in the organization, because they bring in different ideas. For instance, I am from India. And when I work with my clients in the US, I bring in different ideas in terms of strategy, in terms of how much you can reduce your operational cost. Your commodity work can be sent to different countries because that's a repetitive work instead of the other areas where you're talking about creative work, you're inventing something. I'm talking about 24 years back. I'm not talking about right now. I'm talking about offshore work, which was done before Y2K. So I was engaged with the companies. I was working with Dun & Bradstreet. And that's the one of the reasons why I came to this country, to establish these offshore centers and working with my clients. Brought in so much ideas and value, which was, of course, accepted by the companies. And companies know that. Companies know that diversity definitely brings in a lot more creativity, productivity. But at some point in time, when you really bring in intersectionalities, there is always a controversial issues when it is LGBTQ. If I was just an Asian person, it's much different. It's a racial equity. You're just talking about accepting a person from a different race and an immigrant. But now I'm an immigrant, I'm an Asian, I am a trans person. That doesn't sit well with some organizations. It's sometimes because of the ignorance, they don't know how to really integrate you within the companies. Companies know that. Now think about it. In 2030, some more than 70% of the workforce are going to be millennials and Gen Zs. And 27% of the youth in California in 2019, according to Williams Institute, are gender non-binary. They identify as gender non-binary. Now it's 2024. There's a lot happening within the younger generation. There's a lot happening when you take the younger generation who are actually the future of the organizations. The organizations need to start thinking about how do you actually start being more open and accepting and bringing in a lot of ideas and creativity rather than just putting all these brackets and saying that don't talk about this. You are safe. We are open to you. The biggest thing that I saw in the leadership is basically trust. A lot of leaders who are performative, like Budweiser, you have Target, you have lots of other companies. I can name those companies. Even in Netflix, we kept on having these issues. It's because they talk about inclusivity. They have these advertisements and they show these great way of inclusivity. And it's very performative. At times, it's like pink washing. When it really comes to hiring people and retaining them, giving them the equity, I'll tell you, when I was in the company, when I came out, I was looking for a job. And here I was with a beautiful resume of a senior executive. For 1 year, I didn't have a job because they didn't want to hire me at the same level. I said, I was a senior director in these companies. I was actually working with Capgemini. It's one of the top consulting firms. And I want to be in that same level, or I want to be a vice president in these companies. And I was in the consulting field in IT, and I had so much of experience. But the problem that I see is they like your resume, but for them, it's a sticky point on how do we hire, how do we manage this? Is it going to be an overkill for us to have a person like you? And the senior leadership team is thinking about it. They want to bring me in, but they don't know how to bring me in. That's another problem that I see. And when I was actually brought into those companies, now my salary dropped. I remember 30% of my salary dropped when I came into these companies, mainly because if you see salary equity that you probably know, I don't want to go deep into it, but if you take the white man and if you take the white women and then the black man and then people of color, Asian women and then black women, and there is so much of disparity there. And then the trans women, they come in the bottom of the food chain. So if a Caucasian white man is getting $1, the trans women are probably getting 25 cents. And that's the way my salary dropped drastically. And I wanted to bring this change. And I told these companies I can change because they love to hire people, but they don't know how to retain them. And that's the biggest problem that I saw is they love to create these policies, but they're just a vaporware because it's not really transforming the companies. They're just meeting the metrics. They want to hit these DEI metrics in order for them to show that, hey, we have a black person who's a chief diversity officer. We have an Asian person who's part of our board. That is not the way you change a company. You need to have it in the framework of a company. Change doesn't happen from the leadership. Change doesn't happen from the letterhead of the company. Change happens from the heart of the employees. And how can that happen is when the employees feel they belong to the company. It's not about a performative statement making in the media saying that we love LGBTQ, we have this pride flag, and we do all this, but they don't even know what pronouns means. They don't even know what you're talking about. They don't even know that what is gender non-binary. And I remember there was a top executive from one of these media companies, I don't want to mention the name. They came into a call during a Pride event and the CEO was talking about this company and he made so many mistakes, not able to address the trans community in the right manner. And that created such a racket within the company and the leadership team. They were asking, reaching out to folks like myself, asking, what did we do wrong? And I said, it's very simple. All we need to do is listen to the people, you know, listen to the community and understand what they're going through, because it's a little bit different. You're focusing more on the racial equity, but focus on gender equity, where the LGBTQ folks also part of it, and then people with disabilities and the veterans. To me, that is a sliver that is being ignored in all the DEI a lot more than just focusing on racial equity. But also you need to focus on these three areas where there are a lot of need in the companies. And to me, that is so important because All of them are hand in hand.
As a veteran myself, I've actually done quite a bit of advocacy in that area. What you're talking about is there's policy, but then there's practice. And there is a gap there. But you also mentioned about this burgeoning, this emergence of gender identity variations in the younger generations. They're the next wave going into the workforce. And so the goal would be, rather than being reactive to that, is to be preventative or proactive in creating the environment, like starting to set up the foundation for that, because it's not going to work anymore to just come out with rainbow cookies and candies.
Absolutely. You're right. I just want to add one more point, Xander. I think, Ann, you also lead it to that. One of the important things is the leaders are just stuck in compliance. They just want to meet compliance because that's the mandate right now. I remember applying for a job in a company, and this was a LGBTQ panel discussion. There was a big sponsor from one of the corporate firms, and they were talking about how inclusive they are. It's a panel discussion where you had a trans person, the person was black and gay, they were there, all part of a discussion. Great discussion. I was sitting there in the panel discussion and thinking about, are they truly talking about how inclusive they are. And while the panel discussion was going on, I applied for a job in that company on my phone. And when I picked up the phone and I applied, it said male, female, choose not to identify. And I said, you're here. It's a diverse supplier conference, right? I said, you're here.
We're going to have to take a break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour is Celia Sancha Daniels. We'll be back shortly.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour is Celia Sancha Daniels. Celia is recognized as one of the top 20 LGBTQ leaders in biopharma and among the top 10 LGBTQ plus voices on LinkedIn in the US and Canada. She's also listed in the top 100 LGBTQ plus women in DEI worldwide, alongside notable figures as Laverne Cox, Wanda Sykes, and Lily Tomlin. Let's get back to where we left off.
This is in the QA session. When the QA session said anyone had any questions and everyone was saying how great you are, how wonderful you are. They are really good. I mean, I'm not saying they are not. But what they sometimes fail to see is because they're stuck in compliance. And I said, I'm trying to apply for a job in your company and you have come to hire people like me. But what you're telling me is choose not to identify. I want to identify. I want to be a part of your company. But my gender is X according to the license in California. But there is no option for me to enter my gender. And it's important. And if your gateway to the company where I'm a job seeker is not inclusive, how can I believe and trust that your company is inclusive? The director of supplier diversity was just going bonkers because he didn't know how to answer. And I said, I'm saying this with passion and I'm saying this with grace. I mean, I want to be cognizant that you're doing a great work, but sometimes people like me are left out. Now, that's where the leadership is thinking, oh, but that's EEOC. You know, that's what the EEOC is asking for, Celia. It's OFC compliance. That's what they asked for. And I said, that's what happened to women in the workforce. That's what happened to the Black community in the workforce. And they fought for civil rights to be a part of the workforce. There are 450 companies today in this conference. And if everybody raises a petition, they sign a petition and say, we need gender X to be included into this so that people like Celia are being counted in your metrics. How much difference that's going to make? Of course, I know that if the EEOC is trying to create this or X into this. But the people in the companies, you know, the CEOs also need to identify that this is an important aspect. They need to take us seriously.
Well, they can drive it. I mean, why wait?
Yeah.
They can drive it. And also that's minimum standard.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean best practice. That's just minimum. Right. It's a requirement. You can build on that. Absolutely.
Right, right.
Classism exists in corporations.
Mm-hmm.
You just pointed that out.
It's interesting when I talk about the classism and even within the trans community in India, it's so interesting that there is an upper class trans folks in India and then there's a lower class and the Dalit trans are much more suffering today. I don't know where I fall in that because I was raised as a Christian and according to my caste certificate in India, I'm underlining that again. In India, there is a caste certificate. In that caste certificate, I belong to a forward caste. So when I came out as a trans person in India, you're much more known for who you are. If you're a Brahmin trans, you're much more okay. Or you're upper class. That's going to give you some mileage and a leverage versus a person who is a Dalit and who's in the lower caste in India and still trans. Have issues. It's similar to the Caucasian trans folks versus the people of color, Asian trans person who's like me. When I came out in Ventura County, the first thing that I heard was, Celia, you need to transition. And I said, I don't want to transition because I have medical issues and I'm thinking about it. And they said, if you don't transition, then you're just a cross-dresser because they try to undermine who you are. They create a class within their own system. I think human brain works in a way that even within the trans community, within the LGBTQ community, we try to put people into these little buckets that we can comprehend and then we can understand. And that's what exists in other countries like India. And interestingly, when I went back to India, I was sitting in a resort and one of the waiter came to me and he told me in Hindi, he said, ma'am, aap to bahut different lag rahe hain. And I told him, I'm a hijra. What he said is, you look very different. Even though you say you're a hijra, you are not a hijra. And he told me, don't say that you're a hijra. I could tell him that I'm a hijra because that's what he knew. He doesn't know what is transgender. In the English term, he doesn't understand because in the Hindi word, there is no right terminology for actually translating the word hijra to a transgender. So I said, hijra. And he said, no, you're not because you are educated, you are in AUS, and you are rich. So you're not a trans like these people. And I said, I am these people. I am not what you think you are. I had to educate people even in India within the trans. Classism, casteism is so prevalent within our own boundaries and within the LGBTQ community is so appalling to me.
Yeah.
It's a conversation for another day. But let me tell you, it seeps into the corporate industry. And sometimes you could also be influenced by the biases because you're a person of color or you're trans, but you're different.
Also, the issue of within the corporate settings and higher education is when they're hiring for diversity, they're doing it at a very superficial level. They're doing it based on race and ethnicity, mm-hmm. and they're hiring from all the same elite colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And so you have a group of people who look different, but all have the same points of view. And exactly. therefore, that, in my opinion, that's going to stifle true creativity in the workplace, because you're going to get locked into groupthink, because nobody wants to step outside of the expected or prescribed official opinions and viewpoints about certain things. And so I think that this idea of diversity, I like that you bring in the veterans and people with disabilities, and it goes much broader than that.
Just want to add on to that. It's so funny because when you have the four check boxes, I check in trans as the first one, second one is Asian, the third one is I'm neurodivergent. So I'm in the autistic spectrum somewhere, very small, you know, I have a minor symptoms of autism and dyslexia. And also I'm cardiovascular issues. I'm a diabetic. I'm giving away my HIPAA data. But the thing is, I check all the boxes except the veteran. And now, to me, that matters because my dad was a veteran. He fought in the war in India. And my father-in-law fought in the war. My brother-in-law is in the war. They were all part of this community. And to me, it matters a lot. And I speak up. I've been raised in that family. And to me, that is an area that's kind of very much ignored. And you're afraid to come out, even if you're coming out as trans. Now, checking that box as a person with disability, I need to think twice. Am I going to be a project manager? Are they going to give me millions of dollars ownership and P&L because I am checking the box that I am a person with disabilities? Sometimes it matters. You know, it's so important that the companies have this bias. They're going to look through it. I always feel, are they rejecting my resume or rejecting my application because I'm checking that box? So yeah, it does exist. And it's very true. Ageism also is a part of it. I'm 55 years old. Of course, I'm not going to get younger, but I'm going to get wiser. So hire me for that. You know, that's important.
I champion that as a 57-year-old. I champion we get wiser as we get older. You mentioned it in your bio that you're from South India and that you've talked about and you've written about some of the struggles you've had personally that relate to your family. So I'd love to hear whatever you'd like to share with us about what it was like for you as little Celia.
It's such a, but I want to give a trigger warning for the audience, especially who are listening to the story, because these are the stories of the trans community who are struggling in India. When I was 4 years old, I came out to my mom and I said, Mom, I want to be a girl. And I don't know why. But I covered my head with my mom's sari and I pretended to be a girl. My mom looked at the social constructs created by the colonial British government in India that was so binary. And she told me, you can be a girl, because I was 4 years old and I looked very cute. They dressed me up like a girl and they were okay with it. And I ran around the house. And to me, I thought gender was very fluid. In fact, gender fluidity in India exists almost. It's a 4,000-year-old culture. And it was very common in Indian culture. I was running around the house at 7 years old. That's the time my mom told me that you need to stop wearing your cousin sister's skirts because you're a boy. And it hit me so hard that some part of my identity was taken away. And I didn't know why I wanted to be a boy, but at the same time, I was attracted to girls and I wanted to be a girl as well. And I didn't understand gender incongruence at the time, that I was just learning to suppress my femininity and I was learning to survive. And to me, every day, it was a waking moment of what would I do today to prove to the world that I'm a boy. That was the way that I would start my day every day. And living in India, it was really hard in the early 70s. And the community that we lived in was a good community where people were educated because they were part of an atomic power station. So there are a lot of educated people in the community. And if I come out as a trans person, I will mention that in the later part of my conversation now, but even within a community, coming out as a trans person kind of demeans the entire community. And I remember coming out when I was in my ninth grade. I walked out and I wore a skirt and a dress. And in the ninth grade, I was walking outside and I was caught by the security guard in the community. And almost like 20 adults stood around me and they started yelling at me saying, I want to know where your dad is, dad and mom is, because you're such a disgrace to the community. You're here. People like you should not be in this community. Where's your dad? Who's your dad? Why are you here? I didn't know what to do. And they were all yelling at me. And if I were an adult, they would tie me up and they would burn me. And that has happened even to some of my friends in the past 6 years back. There was a trans person who was an engineer. She was raped and murdered and burnt to death. There is so much that is happening in India that people don't talk about because they think that India is inclusive. And here I was in the early 70s trying to come out, and I actually came out and I felt like I couldn't. I went back home and I started contemplating suicide. And that's the time it hit me so hard that when I was almost choking, I felt like I was afraid to die and I was also afraid to live. It was one of those times when you feel like, what am I going to do as a trans person? I want to live. I want to have a life like anyone else. But again, I'm so afraid to even live. How do I do it? I want to die, but I cannot die because I'm afraid to die. It's so hard. This is the story of the trans folks today in this world. And that's when I felt like I didn't know what to do. But I spoke in another language and I quickly lifted my skirt and I ran from there. They didn't chase me because it was really good. And this is the time I felt like I can never come out. I was probably like 11 years old at the time. And I never wanted to come out again in India. It was a bad experience. And when I was in my fourth grade, I was molested by my uncle and my cousin 2 years later. And my life was so messed up that I couldn't even tell my parents about it. Because in India, you don't talk about your traumas. It's always about, if you're a boy, you need to fight. You need to stand up. And that's what you're taught. You're not supposed to talk about your vulnerable side. I went through a lot in India as a child. My therapy was the beach. I used to go to the beach and cry and cry. I never told my parents. My mom was a nurse. In spite of that, I couldn't tell my mom about what I was going through. And my mom at the time thought, maybe my son has got over this and now he's probably okay. But actually, I was not okay because I took it to the closet. I took it to the beach. I took it to places where I didn't want shame. There was so much shame associated with my being Celia. And I didn't know what to do. I was struggling with it for so many years. And my brain went into a state of mind where I said, this is not me. It can never happen to me. And I went into denial for many years. And that's when I was always attracted to girls. So I married this beautiful woman and I said, I'm going to have a normal life and my life is going to be great. I'm going to be this wonderful husband raising children and I'm going to be great. So I married a beautiful woman. It was an arranged marriage. We got married and that's the time I was actually working for Dun & Bradstreet. And Dun & Bradstreet called me to US. They said, hey, you need to come to US. We want you here. I was there for a strategic consulting. So in 97, I came to the US. I came to New York. I was consulting with these companies and deep inside, I felt like, oh, I'm married now. My wife is going to take away my femininity and I'm so cool. You know, everything is going to be amazing. I'm here in the US. I'm going to start my life. 1 year after I came to the country, gender incongruence hit me so hard. What is gender incongruence? Is basically your birth gender and your authentic gender doesn't match. So I was born as a boy, but in my mind and my brain is always telling me that I'm a girl. And so there is an incongruence in your mind that's not working. And there are people like me who are struggling with gender incongruence. So that is what gender incongruence is versus someone who is a cisgender person where the gender and they just identify in the gender they are born. But I don't identify in the gender I'm born. That's where it is. And it was so difficult for me. And I had a child at the time. And here I was, a successful businessman, married, and a beautiful little child. I was so ready to start my life and I was falling apart. And I didn't know what to do. I told my wife, sweetheart, I'm trans. And even to say the word I'm trans was so hard because there was no language for it at the time. I had to tell her that, sweetheart, I like wearing women's clothes. And it was hard. This was in early 2000 when I came out to my wife. And I've been struggling a lot since then. One thing I can tell you, it took 17 years for my wife to accept me. My daughter accepted me in 25 minutes. When she was 12 years old, she saw a picture of me as Celia. And I had never come out to her. When I go for my business trips, I used to change my dress and then just pretend that I'm this person. It was my authentic gender. It was actually like breathing above water. And every time when I go back to being Daniel, it was like putting my head under the water and just trying to breathe. And that is what gender incongruence feels like. It's so relieving. It's so liberating when you put your head above water. And I was struggling so much and I didn't know what to do. And that's the time I felt like there is so much for people like me. And I started discovering. And that's when I realized that I'm not alone. There are so many people in the world across different ethnicities, race, and everybody is like me. And to me, that was so eye-opening. And I started speaking up and I started talking about it. And today, my wife and I have been married for 27 years. And I'm married to a cisgender woman. And she's so loving and accepting. She's my biggest ally. And my daughter is 24 years old now. And she's my biggest ally. I came out to my brother. I came out to a lot of people in our family. And we are all living in... It's not easy because the entire family is transitioning along with me. Now they get it. They understand who I am. They start to give me gifts that are different. My wife is bringing all this makeup and stuff. You know, this. It's such an amazing experience when your family accepts you and they know that people like me need to be supported. And that's the culture that we are living in. We need to live in so that even in the workplace, we need to bring that kind of an accepting culture that this is not something that is, you know, it has to be humanized. Instead of that, it's being politicized, it's demonized. And that's where we are and in a situation where we need to give that humanness back to people like us. And that's what is missing in the corporate industry today.
Mm-hmm. What a beautiful story. I wanted to ask you if your wife had any backlash at all from her family or friends?
Both our parents are gone. I never came out to my parents at all. I wish I had come out because it would have changed a lot of things for me. I would have felt much better. I decided to come out to my brother and he's more accepting. And we are still finding how do I come out to her sister because she's conservative. And they live in India. They don't live here. But some of the family members we have come out to, and sometimes we have to decide whom to come out to. And my wife has been facing some backlash even at work when she has been talking about, she's my ally. So when people talk about trash about the trans community, she stands up and she knows what she's standing up for. And to her, that is so traumatic. Sometimes she feels like, I don't want to come out to them and tell my husband is trans. And I still tell her, you know, call me husband. I use that term. And I told my daughter, call me dad. Yes, they do face backlash, but I can't imagine that they are so strong. And when my wife stands up and speaks up for me, she is just, I don't know where she gets that energy, but she feels like she really loves this human being. The relationship has evolved that I want to be supportive. She said, I want to do everything to support you. I may not understand you, but I want to support you. So please educate me every day. Every day when I go back home, we sit down and talk about what happened in the day. I'll also talk about the podcast. So we talk about pronouns. We talk about so many things. Of course, backlash is going to come, especially if we go to a church. People are going to talk about us. There's a lot going on. That's a conversation for another day. But yes, backlash in the community, backlash in the family. But the most important thing is when you get support from the people who are so much important to you, so significant to you, that really changes the way in which you feel like you have allies, allies within your family, allies within your community who are ready to stand up for you. And that keeps me going. It's not that Celia has so much courage, but I am so surrounded by loving people who gives that courage back to me every day because I feel sometimes down, and that matters. So yeah, that's a good question, Ann, and thank you for asking that. Appreciate it.
We are going to take our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ann and Xander Kagg. We are listening to Celia Sanchi-Daniels, who is an accomplished healthcare management executive with over 25 years of demonstrated success in managing, growing, and spearheading large and strategic programs in IT, healthcare, and life sciences for Fortune 100 companies. We will be back shortly. Stay tuned.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ann, clinical sexologist, and Xander Kagg, licensed social worker. Let's get back to where we left off.
I like what you said about how your wife said she doesn't necessarily understand, but she supports you and wants to advocate for you. And when I hear that, I find that completely acceptable, that I am going to be, my wife and I have been married almost 22 years, and it was 3 years into our marriage that I did my transition. And so Margaret had to come on this journey with me or not. She chose to, and I'm really grateful for that. This acceptance, I don't find that there's a broad acceptance within trans community of the necessity for those who surround us, our loved ones who are also going through a transition of sorts when we go through our transitions. I don't think there's enough compassion, enough grace extended to those individuals to give them the opportunity to go through their process of grief and discovery and discernment to figure out, do I or don't I want to stay? Mm-hmm. And if I choose to stay, how is this going to work? They're still who they are, and they might not want to change their entire lives to accommodate us. How can they exist? How can my wife, how can your wife, how can they retain their own unique sense of self while we're doing what we're doing and living how we're living? I consider that to be a priority in navigating this journey. I run into quite often, I don't know if you do, but I've run into a number of trans people over the last 20 years since I ventured into this world of transness who have very little tolerance for people who don't accept and affirm and get on board in like 5 minutes.
I know. I see that in the PFLAG all the time, the parents coming and crying their heart out saying, my child doesn't accept me because I misgendered them. Of course, that's a conversation I always have with people, that please give them grace. Even in the workplace, someone makes a mistake, you know, correct them with grace. And I remember I was in a Democratic meeting in one of those women sessions. I was having a small breakout session and this lady across the table, she said, oh, Celia, now I get it. You're actually a man who still has a penis and you're dressing like a woman. And she was an old lady. And I was so shocked. I was just, oh, what am I going to say? And the women in my breakout session, they all jumped at her and say, how dare you talk like that to Celia? And how dare you do this? And they were all jumping at her and she was cringing. And she said, I'm so sorry. I don't know what to say. I've never seen a trans person in my life before. And she's probably 65 years old. She's saying, I don't know what to say. And I said, you know, that's okay. What you said is right. Yes, I am a man and I have transitioned into a woman and I've not medically transitioned, but I'm so glad that you understand that, and I wanna educate you. And she almost was crying. And she was like, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean it. And I said, it's okay, and I get it. And after the meeting, she said, Celia, I wanna come and apologize to you if I hurt you. I said, no, you know, that's what is missing today, Xandra. There's a lot of grace that's missing, because sometimes it's in my journey to educate people, and I think that's what we need, to give grace to people who don't understand. And one thing I always say, this, you can always educate people who are ignorant. You can always educate people who are ignorant, but you cannot educate people who are arrogant. And that is what I am mindful of. You know, there are people who know about you. They purposefully, they know that I'm trans, and they would sometimes address me, hey, ma'am, how's your day going? And I said, yeah, my day is great. And then they hear my voice and, all right, sir, here's your bag. And now they know that I am a trans person. And then they try to correct me and they try to say that I'm not accepting to you, so I'm going to call you sir. Seldom in my life I've seen people who are arrogant. I've seen people who are always ignorant, and it's okay. And that's what I do. I educate people. And how trigger, even if it's triggering, I think it's important for us to create that allyship, create that environment where we are, they are open to asking questions. And that's why folks who are cisgender, they don't know what to tell about trans folks. You know, they are afraid they're going to make a mistake. I was always afraid that I would make a mistake around the Black community. And I call my friend and I say, hey, I'm going to make a mistake. Let me ask you this question. So I had a lot of questions I was able to clarify with my Black friend during the Black Lives Matters. And he said, don't call us African-American. I'm not African-American. Call me Black. So there are lots of things I didn't know. And I educated myself. And that's what we need to do. And give that environment where you're saying that, you know, please come and make mistakes. It's okay. It's okay to make mistakes. But, and also you're learning, right? We are all learning. If you stop learning and thinking that we are the best people on earth, I'm sorry, you can be a trans, but if you're a jerk, I'm not going to be happy with you. So that's what I say. Being trans is not my agenda. Being a good human being is my agenda in life.
Absolutely. When people say, I'm afraid of making a mistake, it's for the very reason that that poor woman, that experience she went through, because the other part of it for me is that all those people in that meeting who jumped on her or, quote, called her out, which I'm not a fan of call out culture at all, they thought they were being an advocate. And so instead of letting you respond, they decided it was their job to respond for you. And then they did it in a way that you never would have. And so when I talk to people who are not part of the trans community, I say, listen, I know you want to be an ally. I know you want to go out into the world and help, but your understanding of the trans community is very small. Mm-hmm. It's very narrow. You've met me. You've met maybe another person. You don't really have enough knowledge and exposure to go out there and speak on our behalf. We have our own voices. We can speak for ourselves. And so maybe find another way to be part of our community as an ally, rather than going out and policing what people are saying, because the way you would have handled that situation, obviously we know now, is very different than how they attempted to handle it for you. Did you say anything to any of those other people in the moment or later about how they saw how you did it?
They saw how I did. And I always give grace to people because people have given grace to me. If you want to be an ally, there is an easy way to remember that. The word allies is A-L-L-I-E-S. So A is acknowledge your privilege that you can help. L is to listen to the community, listen to our stories. Another L is to learn to unlearn. And I is to initiate tough conversations and discussions. E is to educate yourself and to educate others. And S is to be supportive by being involved. And this is a thing that I always talk about in most of my podcasts, because we need allies. Especially, we have more than 500 anti-trans LGBTQ bills today in the country. And the only way I think we can help, we need help from the community. We need to build this allyship my wife, my daughter, your wife, your parents, whomever you have, friends, allies. We need allies. We need even co-workers and everyone. When you have this allyship, that's when we can change the world. It's not about just the trans community alone doing this work, but we need that kind of allyship to really, really make a change in this country, in this community, and across the world.
Absolutely. I love that. I love making an acronym out of the word allies. That's really beautiful. Is there anything coming up on the horizon for you? Anything for you personally or professionally?
Follow me on LinkedIn. I have done some work on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. It's Celia San Daniels, which is my middle name. It's spelled as S-A-N Daniels. And you can follow me on my company page. I have a company called Rubicon.com. I'm the founder and CEO. I have a resources page as well. If you're looking for resources, you can go there. You have a lot of resources for medical related issues with LGBTQ community. You have a lot of resources for mental health. You have a lot of resources for any suicidal ideation, also for work-related, DEI-related work and inclusivity in the workplace, inclusive clinical practices. So from a professional standpoint, I've started focusing on educating doctors, nurses. I've been doing that since last year, but I want to focus more this year because we want to change some of the legislation in the country where they are not taking us seriously. And I want to be an advocate right now. I'm also focusing on diversity in clinical trials where we are trying to make a change across the four pillars of healthcare, the providers, payers, pharmaceutical companies, and policymakers. And that's how my approach is. If you want to make a change in the health equity, you need to hit all these four pillars in the healthcare. And that's what I'm focused on. I'm also working with Trans Latina Coalition for putting out some policies for the trans community. So there's a lot of work that I'm doing in the policy side. I'm also educating the providers. I'm also participating in clinical trials to make that change. So this has been an amazing time. And I want to thank you so much for this opportunity. And I am so honored to be part of this conversation. Xander and On, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. And also, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing not just about your professional life and your professional experience, but about sharing things that are much more personal about your family and growing up in India. I really want to just express my gratitude for you to be able to share that deeply with us today.
And I wanted to echo that as well, what you shared. You shared with such grace. And I think that served as an example. That's a very difficult thing for many people to do, to share those personal aspects of ourselves, but you did it with grace, and I personally have to commend you for that. Thank you, Celia.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it.
You have been listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ann and Xander Cagg. We hope that you enjoyed this hour and that you'll join us next time. Thank you for listening.